Stand up.
I am standing up. Just for that, I'm not going to tell you who I am. My name's not Don Locke. My name's Ed, and I'm an alcoholic. Good. Now, let's hear it like the Pacific Group would do it. My name is Ed, I'm an alcoholic. That's better. How do you like that, Clancy? Okay, really. I don't know how long you got to stay here before you stop being moved all the time by things that are happening, because I spent an entire lifetime practicing a way of life to where you don't have to feel anything. You know, people die and you say, oh, well, there's one less car on the road, you know. Nothing. You know, absolutely nothing. You jump in the sack and you say, did we do it? You know, that kind of stuff. And the gal's just like you, and she said, I don't know. And you come here, and it just never ceases to amaze me that for some strange reason in our society, and in within the society, which of course is Alcoholics Anonymous, those of us who really felt unloved, I mean, we felt unloved, man. When you have to resort to as much alcohol and drugs as I did, you feel unloved, you know. And then I come here, and I meet a lot of people that have felt unloved. And what happens? We start loving one another. It blows me away. And none of us know how. You know, we do make a few mistakes along the road, but none of us know how. But we do it anyway. And somewhere along the line, we find ourselves, you know, feeling things. Nothing in the world probably blows me more away. Thank you. Vodka and seven? Then to go to the little answering machine I have, and turn it on, and somebody will say, I just call you to tell you I love you. It blows me away. It just absolutely blows me away. Because they are trying to attribute the fact that somewhere along the line in my sobriety that I did something special. And what I did is I showed up for my own cookies, is what I did. I arrived. I needed them. They didn't need me. I still feel that way, you know. When I go to Alcoholics Anonymous, you don't need me, but boy, do I need you. The longer I come here, the more I realize how much I need you. And I need you as much as I needed drugs and alcohol. And only a good old Dauphine know that. Because I went to any lengths to get loaded. I'm sure some of you have done that. Didn't make this what it was. I got loaded first, and then we did what we were going to do. If we could remember what we were going to do, we did it. But I got loaded first. And once I got loaded, then I didn't have to do anything. And I am the great anesthetizer. In other words, the capacity to remove the ability to feel anything. By the time I arrived here, I was an absolute champion. And the reason I know that is because that when my own mother died, I thought to myself very philosophically, that would really is nice. Now she won't have to suffer anymore. And just passed it off. And I thought Plato would have said something like that. But I didn't feel anything. Didn't know how to feel. Never did know how to feel. My entire lifetime. And I find out that the reason I use drugs and alcohol is because of the fact that there's no way in the world you can roam around Glendale, where I came from, feeling the way I felt, and not just want to do yourself in. And if it hadn't have been for Ernest and Julio, a couple of Italian fellas, I probably never would have had the opportunity to have gotten out of that prison. And my first, you know, trip out of the prison of self was with Ernest and Julio. I really owe those guys a lot, those two Italians up there in Modesto, California. Because you can take an ugly, my friend Ed and his acne, and, you know, I had that too. I had a big nose, carrot top hair, liver lips. And I just roamed around the streets of Glendale, just so goddamn ugly that, you know, that even the dogs crossed the street, you know. And if I would cross the street, cars would stop and all laugh, you know. And I never even looked in the mirror, you know. I'm like, it's got to be like a vampire. I didn't want to see how ugly I was. And I still maintain that if it hadn't been for alcohol, I don't know how I could have possibly have lived on this planet, you know, when everybody was taller, better looking, smarter, richer, and all I had was, ugh, you know, 2-inch turd I packed around in my belly, you know. And you can't make love when the girl knows you have a 2-inch turd. They just won't have anything to do with you. Scared to death of women, and you know, didn't know about, you know, about West Los Angeles. I didn't. And I, you know, and it really makes it very, very difficult. But then I discovered alcohol. This is before I discovered drugs. My first love was Ernest and Julio. And then a few years later, I discovered good old non-habit-forming grass, you know. A lot of people always say to me, why do you call it non-habit-forming grass? Well, I smoked it every day for 10 years, and I didn't get addicted. Didn't hurt me a bit. That's why, you know, that guy's over there smiling at me. I know that he knows something. But one nice thing about marijuana, you smoke it long enough, bushes will follow you down the street. Is that right?
Yep.
In fact, there's one right behind you there. He looked over at the girl.
Go get him.
And then when I discovered weed, that's what really did it. Because you don't have to go get any formal education. You don't have to do anything. You don't have to do any of that kind of stuff. All you got to do is smoke a little of that weed, and there you are. It's like 14 degrees all at once. You know, there you are. Somebody putting blades on your shoulder and telling you that you've been knighted. Because there you are. You're cool and your hair grows. I don't know why it grows. It's just something about marijuana and hair. I just don't know what it is. You know, the more you grow, the more you get. I don't know what it is. It's just the way you grow. Matter of fact, some days, you can close your eyes and feel it grow. I'm sure some of you smoke that kind of weed. And of course, I looked a little different than those in Glendale looked. They were wearing coveralls with one strap. That's before coveralls were cool. And I wore pants up to here with a 1.5-foot zipper, which proves, right, that I have a tendency to overcompensate for my inadequacies, right? I did to check that out with the doc, because he's monitoring all this. He'll call me tomorrow and said, you should have said. But you know, anything that can make you feel that good is worth going all the way for. I mean, so they say you're not going to live. And one of my theme songs that I used to love, there used to be a guy named Harry the Hipster Gibson. Now, you got to be old if you know who Harry the Hipster Gibson is. But he used to sing a song, and it used to go something like this. Live fast, die young, and have a good-looking corpse. And that was kind of our theme song, because who wants to live to be past 30 anyway? I mean, do it. I mean, do it. Make love to about 9,000 gals and just have fun and go out into space and be, you know, and be resuscitated about 15 times. And then eventually one day say, God damn, that was fun. Okay, God, I'm ready. And that's the way I kind of looked at it. Because somewhere along the line, if you smoke weed, eventually nothing happens. That's why I think the expression got started. What's happening, man? As a matter of fact, for years I thought I was being hip. I now know I was asking a question. What's that, man? You know. But when you get cool, there's nothing like being cool. You can't, nothing in the world. In other words, the coolest people I've ever seen is out on the big yard in some penitentiary. I mean, you go out there, you know, go to a meeting, and them dudes is cool, baby. You know, they got the black ones over here and the brown ones over here and the honkies and patties over here. Depends on which way you're looking. But they're all so cool, man. You know, and doing a nickel, doing a dime, you know, all that heavy shit, man. They got the polished shoes and talking about dope and broads and cars and big, you know. And then they get paroled. Then they talk about the penitentiary all the time they're on the street. But the one nice thing about it is you're cool. Some guy's going to get, they're going to drop the pellet on him tonight, you know. And the other guys are saying, yeah, but he's cool, man. He is cool. Matter of fact, when they strap him down, the last thing you'll see is this. That dude is cool. And ain't nothing. If you've never been cool, you don't know what you miss. Being cool, you can be laying on the floor with regurgitation all over you, wet drawers, whatever. You don't have to get on a bus. You see anybody riding on that goddamn bus, you know. I'm cool, man. You know, when you're cool, man, you can just do anything. And, you know, look down, and any normal person from society would look and say, look at that slob. They call it 647F, and, you know, in them courts over there. But anybody knows that knows you, that you cool, man. That is one cool dude. That dude hadn't moved for 2 days, man. I'm going to keep trying. I'm going to be that cool someday. Look at him. A yoga would be green with envy. You can just stare at walls catatonically for hours. And that's cool. The only problem with being cool is that they expect you to do other things, like show up. You know, and if you happen to make the mistake, one thing I never could figure out is why cool people get married. I never have figured that out. Because if you marry somebody, they're liable to have kids anyway. And then they're expecting this cool dude to be a father. Well, you don't smoke dope, you know, and take pills, and you don't do that to raise kids. You do that when you walk into that saloon, they know you're heavy. And the musicians will holler down, hey, what you say, Red? How you doing, man? Hey, baby, thanks for dropping in, man. That's what counts. You don't feed the kids. You cool. You walk out of there. You sit down alongside of some gal that wouldn't have spit on you 20 years ago. You look at her and you know you could drive her crazy, man. As soon as you get ready. And the only problem with being an alcoholic addict is you're always getting ready. As my friend Ray G says, let's stay here and have a little fun first. You know. And it's hard to explain to anybody that the reason I started getting loaded in the first place was so that I didn't feel lesser than I could have what it was that I wanted, the capacity to walk up and just take out a gal and feel comfortable and know that I was, you know, okay. But if you use drugs, I find out now, long enough and drink alcohol long enough, you don't remember why you're doing it. You know, you go into bars, you're not looking for girls anymore, you're just trying to wonder how long you can stay there without falling. You know, that kind of stuff. Or coming to, trying to figure out where you are, which is a nice game. Jail's always fun. You wake up in jail. You know you're in jail. There's no doubt about it. Absolutely no doubt about the fact you're in jail. The problem is, which one? Then you have to ask. You know, I missed a few. I missed San Dimas. I wish I'd have gone to. Never did go to San Dimas. I understand it's nice, you know. Holland Park, Glendale, Lincoln Heights, all those good ones. County, 13th floor. Looking out at all the squares going by. Me and the other heavy dudes. They're trying to tell us we shouldn't use drugs, you know. I mean, somebody who doesn't even know what he's talking about. Some old cotchety old judge sitting up there looking down at you saying, you use dope, son. I remember that old guy. No, sir, I smoke weed. He said, that's dope. I said, no, Your Honor, that's weed. He didn't understand. He said, well, that's 30 days for weed, then. You better give him 60 days, you do it in your pants, yeah? Jimmy likes that one. But the amazing part of all this insanity is the fact that children start showing up. You know, what are you going to tell a little kid when you're gone? You don't even know you're gone. You know, you don't even know what gone is. I mean, what do you tell a little kid? Smoke a joint, kid? Kids are crying. Give them some reds, Mom. You know. How can you be a father when you leave the house, get a loaf of bread, and come back a week later? You know, and you don't even have the bread. Then your wife asks some dumb, logical, non-alcoholic question, irrelevant question, like, where have you been? Like you knew. I never knew where I'd been. I was always the most amazed guy in the world to come out of a blackout and find myself in my own house. I said, my God, how do you do that? Because it always wasn't always that way. Back seats of cars. That was always fun. Somebody else's house. But one night I found myself, I was in a blackout and I wandered into my dear old mother-in-law's room. She had one glass of wine every Christmas and only drank half of it. And I wandered in there and I was in the blackout. And she hollered at me, "Addy," and I was peeing in her drawer. And she was a little farm girl from Minot, North Dakota. And she had this weird looking dude for a son-in-law. Dance up to here, D.A. hairdo shades. I called her man. She really didn't understand that. I said, "What'd you say, man?" And I had my shades on all the time. I even slept with them on, you know. Never take your shades off when you're cool. But the one nice thing about that type of insanity is that you're not going to be here long in that state, guaranteed, you know. Because somewhere along the line, I completely lost any touch with any kind of reality. Didn't know what it was. I mean, passing out and coming to and laying on beds and taking reds to try to get calm and regurgitating straight up and watching it go up. And then you can't move and then watch it come back down. And then when it hits you in the face, you say, "God, that's fun." And that's what I thought fun was when I met you. And what makes it all so ironic is the fact that the day before I met you, I did not know what the problem was. Hadn't the slightest idea. I didn't have any clues. I had no idea that it was something as simple as an alcoholic and I can't drink. I never knew that. I figured you got to figure out how to drink even if it kills you. You got to be able to do it. This time it'll be different. And I tried. Boy, did I try. And the one thing that I'm grateful for, that may not be true of everybody in AA, but it certainly is true of my case, I drank all I could. That's all there was, and I couldn't drink any more. And I couldn't smoke one more joint. I couldn't do anything. I just, there I was, with that not-at-home look, knocking on my own damn door. And my wife opening the door, and there I stand. "Hi, honey." 116, 117 pounds. I didn't have the slightest idea what was wrong. My father-in-law was paying the payments on my house and feeding my kids. And, oh, boy. I didn't even know what was wrong. I was trying to go back to drinking alcohol because it was legal. And I find out that, for me, I can't take anything. Because when I do it all the way, you know. And so all she said to me that particular night, she took a look at me. And she had talked to a gal by the name... It was Jack's wife's, sponsor's wife. And as she was one of the earliest Al-Anons, Jack's sponsor's wife. And her name was Eddie. And it's funny, so is mine. And she told her that when I came home, that all the symptoms that I was demonstrating, like peeing on the floor, throwing up on myself, not coming home for days, you know, all that kind of stuff, sounded like I might be alcoholic. There was an outside chance. And she said, if he is an alcoholic, what you'll have to do is put him in Camarilla and give him Thorazine. Because he's crazy. What are you going to do if somebody pees their pants and they're not alcoholic? You know, throws up on themselves and they're not alcoholic. Goes away for days, don't know where they are if they're not alcoholic. What are you going to do with them? Give them a frontal lobotomy, I guess. But she said, I'll bet he's alcoholic. But you can't tell him. That's the trick. Don't tell him. For God's sakes, don't tell him he's alcoholic because he'll prove to you he's not. I'm no goddamn alcoholic. Boy, I'm sure glad they didn't have court cards and I got sober. I wouldn't have come to this goddamn place, boy. Down here with a bunch of sober psalm singers, you know, not on your life. And so she gave me the telephone number, and I called this number. The only place, they only had one central office in California in those days, and that was downtown. And this little guy answered the phone. He said, "Alcoholics Anonymous." I said, "I know a guy with a drinking problem." He said, "How long's it been since you had a drink?" on how he knows me. I said, all day. Might have been about 2 hours, as a matter of fact. So he said, I'll send somebody out. And about last February, I think, Bobby was there. Last February, they had the a meeting out there, a long-timers meeting out in San Fernando Valley at that roundup they have out there. Fantastic get-together. Then they asked me to participate. And I come driving up there with Ginny, and I come right around the corner, and I look over there, and standing on the curb about to step off was the guy who made the 12-step call on me over 35 years ago, Johnny. And I hollered over to him. I said, hey, Johnny, have you made any 12-step calls lately? He said, not lately, Ed. I got to thinking to myself, the old son of a gun's still here. Still there, old Johnny, you know. And I never will forget Johnny, and he's Jack and me will never forget Johnny. He's the kind of a guy that has so much peace of mind, he drove you crazy. He didn't have live and let live on his bumper sticker. He had it in his heart. And he had an old three-speed gear shift car, and he'd take guys like Jack and me out to road camps. And he'd put the car in first gear, speed up a little, then he'd skip second and go to high. And Jack and me would say, let's get there, man. Let's go. Let's go. You know, it's like Johnny reminded me of the Southern girl who tried to tell some guy she wasn't that way before she could tell him she was. You know that, you heard that story. Well, that's the way Johnny was. He just took him all day to say anything. And he said the dumbest things, like, go where the most of it is. What do you want? That's where you go, where the most of it is. Right here's the most of it. I thought, what kind of shit is that? He must have been off in North Hollywood a time or two, huh? You know. And I wound up in that Burbank group. And something happened now, you know. Now, for many, many years, I was convinced that if you worked the steps and did all that kind of stuff, that what actually happened was your percentages of coincidences started increasing. If you pray, you get another coincidence. And coincidence number one was that I showed up at my first meeting in Burbank, and it was a little Quonset hut, and the place was packed that night because Chuck Chamberlain was a speaker. Must have been 30 people there. On stools. That's before Jack got there. And I look in that goddamn place, and there's some guy in there standing at the door. They had a door greeter, and he would greet you. And the reason they always stuck somebody at the door is because he couldn't do anything else, you know. And I met this guy at the door, and his name was Eddie McDee. Now, you've never lived if you didn't know Eddie McDee. Eddie McDee could get off the podium and break his leg. You know, he put his hand out the back of a truck, and they take off his arm. I mean, just was an accident of walking. You remember old Ed McDee? And he had uppers, but no fast teeth. And as he talked to you, they dropped. And he had a big scar on his face. And he'd just gotten out of the penitentiary because he liked to hang paper. And he signed his own name. And I asked him one day, why do you sign your own name? This was a long time later. And only an Alki would give this kind of an answer. And only an Alki would understand it. He said, because I meant to pay it back. He was hanging paper on banks he didn't even have accounts in. And they frown on that in Texas. They put him in a slam. California, he'd been in Arkansas, all in big slams, big time slams. Now here I am, what is known as an old hot minute. You know, I've been in a bucket a time or two. I've been in there for possession of drugs, DUI, that kind of stuff. Nothing heavy, you know. In the bucket in there, trying to protect my virginity, you know. Well, when you're ugly, you don't have to worry about that. As a matter of fact, I just found out recently why a guy made alcohol. That's so that the ugly people could get laid, too. You know? I see I'm getting some extra grins from a few. Like Cliff Wilson used to say, you know who you are. Oh, boy, you know. And Bobby, son of a gun, if I didn't walk up to that big Eddie McDee and that old teeth dropping down there like that, and he said to me, are you alcoholic? And I said, just a little bit. And he laid that pregnant crap on me. You can't be a little bit pregnant. You know, I want to hear that shit. I mean, I'm not really bad, you know, I mean. But here I am standing there talking to him. Coincidence number one. I told him, I said, well, you don't understand, I might have to go to jail. Now, I'm talking about maybe 3 or 4 weekends for driving my head on dashboard. I'm talking to a guy who's been in the penitentiary. But I don't know that. God knows that, but I don't know that. And he said, shut up, punk, and sit down. That's what he said to me. Well, he'd been in jail a long time, but I call me no punk. I'm no punk, man. I'm the punker, not the punkie. Right, Ed? Were you the punker? Yeah, you the punker. Yeah, you know, he told me to sit down and shut up, but I said, but you don't understand, I might lose my kids. And it's the God's truth. Jack remembers. He didn't even know where his kids were. Hadn't seen them for ages. He had 2 boys. Then he really told me to sit down and shut up. All of a sudden, I was trying to impress him that my family, you know, I see people stay away from AA for that. I like to go to AA, but I got a family. It's the reason you got a family, dummy. You know, and this is what he said to me. He said, sit down and shut up. And about a year and a half, I guess, maybe 2 years after I got sober, somebody connected with AA found his kids in Texas. Didn't they, Jack? And they came out and lived with him until they grew up to be young men. And I sat down in that meeting, boy, and I'll tell you, I had one cell flickering. I mean, when you don't go any farther than grammar school, junior high school, and 3 more years of woodshop, auto shop, and gym, and then you start taking drugs that diminish your capacity, you don't have much going up there. I was in AA 4 years and still saying Ananamanam. And Ananamanam, you know. And I'm sitting there like this, boy, and I'm telling you, Barker, that one cell is flickering. Not too bright, but it's flickering. And I look up on the wall, and they had a Serenity Prayer. I looked up at that, and I said, my God, I'll never remember all that. Never remember all that. That was my first thought. I don't remember leaders, readers, or anything else. All I remember, you know, and if anybody didn't meet the man and you're new and you came in since then, all I can say is you don't know what you're missing. Because those of us that knew him, we loved him. You know, I got a picture of Mike and Chuck at home in my den, both of them just laughing about something. I don't know what the hell was about to laugh about, you know. And he was the speaker that night. I never seen him before in my life, you know. 6'1", 6'2", broad shoulders, good-looking guy. And he gets up like this and he says, hi, y'all! He had that oaky accent, right? Hi, y'all! Then he got up and he went, well, I'm telling you, man, my paranoia really come back now, boy. I mean, somebody told him I was here, you know. And he laughed, and I have heard people for years said, I don't know what it was. I told some guy after the meeting, I said, that guy was looking right at me. And he said, I thought he was looking right at me. And I found out everybody in the room thought he was looking right at them. But he had some kind of power. I don't know what it was. People say, oh, he was just another AA. Maybe just another AA to somebody else. But he wasn't just another AA to me. Because I walked in there with one cell flickering. All I ever talked to was cool dudes going to jail or getting out, you know. It's the only people I ever knew. I didn't know anything about people that were living and loving and laughing. I didn't know anything about people like that. And for some reason, when I'm just about to die, I leave the planet. They're out there digging the hole. I can hear them. Is he dead yet? You know, I can hear him. I'm sitting down at that meeting. I'm watching this guy laughing. They're all laughing. I couldn't figure out what the hell was going on. I couldn't figure out what was going on. And I kept saying to myself, what the hell's going on here? Then he got to crying, this grown man. I saw it again here tonight. He got to crying. I thought, what the hell's going on here? I mean, I never seen anything like that before. My mother used to tell me, men don't cry. You know, little boys don't cry. Men do. I didn't know that. And people were crying all around me. I couldn't figure out what they were crying about. You ever been in a room where they were telling jokes and you're the only one didn't get it? I don't know what the hell was going on. And that's why I tell you what's going on. And when the meeting ended, somebody said, oh, by the way, are there any alcoholics here? I said, I am. But I thought they said, do you want some? Because I thought that he was on some. It has to be. I mean, I've tried being sober, haven't you? All I ever got out of it was halitosis, hemorrhoids. Yeah, I'm not drinking. Oh, God damn. How long do I got to do this? I thought sobriety was a sentence. You know, honest to God, you know. And then I met a guy, and, you know, and he's not with us anymore. He died last year of lung cancer. And he ran the Narcotics Anonymous Central Office out there, out of his home for probably 25 years. His name was Jimmy Kinnon. God love him. I met him at that meeting, and he understood gibberish. Nobody else on there understood. I mean, the language that I spoke was not the language they spoke, you know. I used words like uppers, they thought I meant teeth. you know. I talked about dropping reds. They thought I was killing communists. They didn't know what I talked about in that group. And I didn't know what they were talking about. But for some reason, Jimmy understood gibberish. And I had a question for him, because that guy that spoke absolutely blew me away, and I didn't know why. Blew me away. I didn't hear what he said. Other than, it's terrific. That's all I heard him say. And I knew he was on something then. And I asked Jimmy, I said, what's he on? Jimmy said, what do you mean, what's he on? I said, the dude that was rapping, man. He said, oh, you mean the rapping dude, yeah. He said, the rapping dude, he said he wasn't on anything. I said, oh, that rapping dude was on something, man. I mean, did you hear that dude rap, man? That dude was rapping. He said, yeah, I heard that dude rapping. I said, but what's the dude on? He said, dude's not on anything. I said, how come the dude's feeling so good? He said, that dude's not feeling good because of what he's taking. He's not taking anything. He's got to be taking something, man. What's he taking? He said, he feels good because of what he's giving away. I said, run that by me one more time. What do you mean by that? I mean, there isn't anything more diametrically opposed to the philosophy of a me, 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 I. A lousy world, better world if you don't straighten out. And he's talking about a 180-degree turn here. He's talking about giving. Giving what? I find out if you tell an alcoholic, you got to learn to give. Give what? I don't have anything to give except I hate you, your sons of bitches. And that old lady of mine, man. And I got a lousy goddamn job. That's all I got to give. You ever been to a newcomer meeting? You know about the refrigerators and rooms are not clean and all kinds of shit, man. All that good stuff. And actually what's happening, I mean, you're either dying or you're not ready. You come in here, you got to be. I'd love to make it in AA, but I think I'm going. You know. You're ready, man. Sit over there. You know. That's where I was when I got here. And what it was that man had, I wanted. I didn't know what it was, but I wanted it. And they told me I had to give it away. I didn't know what it was. Now, we used to have a guy. Matter of fact, he was a good friend of mine. Eddie Millen. Mac. Jack. A lot of people in here knew him. Matter of fact, there's an expression in AA. You hear it all the time. Keep coming back. Matter of fact, his name was Keep Coming Back Maury. And that's what Jimmy said to me. Because I want it, you know. In other words, if it's something that's good, you put it in your arm, right? You smoke it, you drink it, snort it, you do something with it. What's this keep coming back stuff? Imagine knocking on your connection's door. Keep coming back. Don't make any sense, man. What is it? Where do I take it? Keep coming back. Keep coming back. Keep coming back. Drive you nuts. Absolutely drive you nuts. And the one thing that I haven't done anything else really well, except that I've kept coming back, you know. I've been following guys around like Mike for years, and there's a lot of us sort of started teaming up. My friend over there, Ralphie and Jack, in comes Jack, you know. The only reason Jack's over tonight is because they put in automatic pin setters. Hadn't been for that, he'd still be drunk, you know. They said, we don't need you anymore. And he said, no, what am I going to do, you know. So he had to go get sober, you know. And we've been running around here for years, you know. We like to say, well, we really wouldn't know what we're doing, you know. I could like to have a dime for all the meetings I went to with Jack. We were watching these guys up in front. They had 5 years sobriety, six. One guy had seven. We copied every word he said down, didn't we, Jack? It easy does it. You get that, Jack? We ran that down, man. Live and let live. God damn, man. What's he going to say next? Oh, Clyde Davis. Oh, God almighty. Listen to that boy. I saw Clyde last year, got 40 years. 40 goddamn years. When they told me to keep coming back, they meant they were going to do it, too. And they said, you keep coming back and great things will happen to you. And the one nice thing I like about AA, you know, it's better than drugs and alcohol, is that when something happens to you, you know it. If you're getting divorced, you know it, boy. I mean, you know it. When they repossessed your car, but I'm sober. Yeah, but you didn't make the goddamn payments. What the hell's that got to do with? God's supposed to provide. Done that old shit. God doesn't know anything about beneficial finance. Got something I want to tell you, fella. He said, you're praying too much and not working enough. That's what he said. You do a little more work and a little less praying. I said, okay, I'll start doing that. Funny how you get hung up and praying and don't do anything else. Yeah. I was praying so hard one day, they said, to make a 12-step call. I said, well, I will when I get through praying. By that time, somebody else went. You get busy. But for some reason, we stayed here. And I never think I'm getting any better until I look back. And then I begin to find out that as I stay here, I get better than I was. But there's some need that I had that is specifically alcoholic. And I realize it's alcoholic. I see it in other people. I see it in new people all the time. And I realize that I did the same thing. Because I had a tremendous need to be better than somebody else. I mean, it's what it was. If it's just something I could drive, that'll do it. I like to look out the window, some guy in an old turd, and I got this big, whatever, anything. Just something that would make me feel bigger. And I've always needed it. I've tried a lot of things. Don't say the F word. Give it up. No more F word. I quit smoking. Didn't smoke anymore. Didn't use the F word. Meditated all the time. Matter of fact, I got so good that I wouldn't associate with you if you did smoke or use the F word. They don't use the F word in my car. Clean up your mouth, fella. Which actually meant is that I'm better than you. I got to be better than somebody. I don't give a shit who it is. I got to be better than somebody. One day Chamberlain told me. He said, only the most inadequate has to be better than somebody. He said, Alcoholics Anonymous just teaches you how to be better than you. That's what gives you gratitude. Being better than somebody else will give you momentary pride, that's all. You know. Give me a brand new car, I polish it for a week. 3 weeks later, I forget where the car wash is, you know. Get a new suit, wow, man, you know. A couple weeks later, don't care. But looking back on my life and realizing that you can't, and Mike, Ed, all of us have said it, you can't walk in the door where you start and arrive at the places that where we are today. You may say, well, where is that? Show me your bank account. I wish I could. You got a new Mercedes? No, not yet. You got a friend who sells them, maybe I get a discount. After I buy it, then I'll have to go see my friend over there, have my head worked on. Then I'll have to go get Jimmy and see Jimmy for how I got the money to buy it. But if I can be better than me, that's really all that counts. But if I don't know that I'm better than I was, and that I can get better than I am, then I'm no place at all. And the thing I like about Alcoholics Anonymous, the more I know that's wrong with you, the more I know that's wrong with me. And the less that I know that's wrong with you, the less there is wrong with me. And the day that I can walk into any meeting anywhere and all I can see is wonderful people doing the best they can, I'm in a really good place. But if I walk into a room and all I see is assholes, then I'd better go home and get a proctologist. And, paradoxically, the co-founder of Alcoholics Anonymous, guess what kind of a doc he was? Proctologist, that's right. I don't know whether that's supposed to be that way or not, but that's what he was. He was an asshole doctor, he really was. You know what he used to tell? As a matter of fact, everybody wants to think that Dr. Bob was so spiritual, you know, that he could walk across the pool. But what he used to tell his lady, his secretary, whenever he got a call from a drunk, he'd say, I got to go see a drunk, make the assholes wait. Well, he did. No, he did. He really did. He really did. I got that in the horse's mouth. I really did. Meaning that being sober and talking to another alcoholic was even more important than a profession, as important as being a doctor. It was more important to him. And I got to think to myself, remember the last thing he ever said when he, the last talk that he ever gets is probably the most beautiful thing that probably could ever be said by anybody in Alcoholics Anonymous. He said, just keep it simple and love one another. Now, it's got to be more complicated than that. There's got to be metaphysics or something. I mean, how about yoga? How about levitation or something like that? How about being able to go up to a mountain and have the lightning flash or something? I mean, really, really crazy. Or start your own group. That'd be good. The Eddie group. I'm going down to the Eddie group, you know, that kind of stuff. And I find out now exactly what Chuck said, that you can only get better than you were, but you got to be want to get better than you are. You got to need to know that you need to know that you need to get better than you are. And somebody said, where are you today? I'm better than I was, but not as good as I can be if I just keep coming back. But how fast do you grow? God damn.
You ever hear about slowbriety?
Can you imagine, since December the 2nd, 1951, this is the best I've gotten? Do you realize how slow that is? But compared to where I start with, this is absolutely a miracle. Because the things that were missing out of my life was the fact that nobody loved me. Nobody cared. Nobody understood. And I find out that when a person feels that way, they make themselves unlovable. That's the way I always was. And I come here to Alcoholics Anonymous, and you love me anyway. You love me anyway. You just love me anyway. I remember Sullivan. God, love him. Remember Sully? He come up to me one day, and he asked me to talk in Culver City. I never will forget this. I'm pretty about 2 or 3 years old, sober, maybe 4 or something like that. And he came up to me after, and he put his arm around me, gave me a big hug, and I like Mike. I wasn't used to that kind of stuff. He came up and gave me a hug, and this is what he said. He said, "Ed, you're beautiful. Alcoholics Anonymous need you." And I said, "I wonder why he says that. I'm nobody. I know I'm nobody. I mean, what can I contribute to anything? He's telling me that I'm beautiful. Alcoholics Anonymous needs me." It's almost like they can see something that's there long before you even get an inkling that it even exists. I think what he's talking about is that what I was trying to kill was not me in the first place. I was trying to kill the not me. The real me has never evolved. That's why Chamberlain always said, uncover, discover, and discard. Uncover, discover, and discard. Uncover, discover, and discard. How long you do that? He said, you keep doing it, and I'm doing it too. And he said, little by little, you start finding more pieces of yourself. And you find yourself caring. You find yourself loving. That's why it's so emotional for me when I see so many friends like they're here tonight. That I've known for years. Chamberlain used to say something that never made any sense. Because I got to be on the big, well, I was a big circuit speaker one time. I kind of backed out of that old crap, you know. I just, you know, once a week, that's enough for me. I have to go out and share a little bit. So I used to be the big circuit speaker. Well, now, when you're the big circuit speaker, you are really something. I mean, you're in Texas, you're in Oklahoma, you're in Arkansas, man. You are big, you know. You're pushing Bill Wilson, right? But I didn't have anything going at home. Absolutely nothing at home. Come on home, sit on home, then get it, and leave again. The big speaker's out somewhere, but nothing going on at home. And this is what Chamberlain told me one time. He said, "Ed, you don't have any program until you bring it home." And I thought, what does he mean by that? Well, man, I was in Houston, Texas last week. I was a banquet speaker. You don't have any program until you bring it home. What you're doing is going out and getting applause. You need that much applause? What happens to you after the meeting's over with? You go up in your room, you're all by yourself. And I say, yeah, what happened? I'm all alone. Did you ever be the banquet speaker at a convention where there's 3,000 people, and they all applaud you and hug you, and then you go up to your room, you sit there, and you feel all alone? I've done it. You sit up there all alone. Nobody cares. They just left me in my goddamn room all by myself. One guy's going to take me to the airplane tomorrow and hope they never see me again. I know it. I know it. I know they never want to ever see me again. You know. I felt that way. And I find out there isn't anything that surpasses being just a member of this fellowship. And that's why they have the word anonymous, you know. And that's why I love what a guy that used to be a musician, I haven't seen him for years, a beautiful guy. He wrote music for all the Hollywood scores. They asked him to talk at the old Pacific group one time. And he got up and he said, "My name is so-and-so and I'm an alcoholic. And I'm certainly glad the highest you can get in Alcoholics Anonymous is sober." And a pall fell on the whole building. And I realized what he was talking about. There's no stars in AA. There isn't anybody that's bigger, better, got more sobriety than anybody else. Because if I can't go home after this meeting and be loving to my own woman, then I don't have much of a goddamn program. It's all bullshit. But I've stayed here long enough now that I can go home. And there's a few guys out there that play dominoes once in a while that always are riding my ass. "How's the love affair going, Ed?" I said, "Beats dominoes, man." Matter of fact, we don't let them come to the meeting unless they bring a domino with them. They have to show it to us first. We don't want to take you away from the game, man. I asked one guy, "Why do you play dominoes all the time?" He said, "If I ever go back to the penitentiary, I'll be a champ." I thought, hell, that makes sense. If you're alcoholic and you're on Thorazine, that makes a lot of sense, you know. Well, all I want to do is to do what Alcoholics Anonymous promised me. And that is the fact that I could get up in the morning and spend a day with me and not want to destroy me because I think there's nothing here. But I find myself caring and loving, and that's what Chamberlain used to tell me all the time. Find yourself caring and loving. And I used to say this all the time, and it used to absolutely drive me crazy. He said, "I feel fantastic." He said, "I feel absolutely terrific right at this particular moment. Now I only have one thing left to do. What can I do to add to your life? And I thought, why does he say that, man? I mean, you feel so good, you want to know what you can do to add to my life? I remember one time picking him up and taking him up to a place, and I was going to be the leader, and he was going to be the speaker. And I said to him when he got in the car, I said, isn't this fun? We're going up to Hunger, Loch Fenn up there someplace. And I said, we're going to get so much out of that. He said, you may be going up there to get. I'm going there to give. And I was sober 15 years when I said that to him. I still didn't get it. I was going up there so they would know I was there. There, look at that guy. He's so spiritual. I bet he's going to walk on water just any day now. You know, Chamberlain told me that when I told him. I said, I don't use the F word anymore. I don't smoke. I said, I'm really getting spiritual. He said, there's only one problem with that. You're no earthly good anymore. He said, if I can find a Catholic priest somewhere who doesn't smoke, you can make a 12-step call on him. Other than that, you can't talk to anybody else. And I realized now, I don't want any facades. I don't want to be anything more. And the whole world, you know, someday wants to put a tie on me. I have no idea why they want to put a tie on me. You know, it took us 500 years to get rid of the goddamn wigs. I wouldn't surprise me that some people start wearing wigs again, you know, put the wigs on, powdered them, you know. And the reason I don't wear ties is I don't like ties. I don't work where I need a tie. I don't do any of that. If I even go into a courtroom, I don't wear a tie. I just never wear a tie. You know, people say, you got to wear a tie. I say, why you got to wear a tie? You wear a tie. I don't want to wear a tie. Even Harvey doesn't have a tie on tonight. Clancy, no, you don't have a tie on? Oh, okay. Okay, all right. Anyway, the great joy of my life today, my great joy of my life, is in the essence of being just being sober. And the true joy of it is the fact that when I go home, most of the time, not all the time, but when I go home, I know that I can love. And I don't know how well, but I know that I can love. I know little dumb things like how my wife likes her coffee. I never knew that about my first wife. I haven't got the slightest idea whether she even liked coffee or not. I know what kind of music that she likes. Jenny and me like exactly the same kind of music. The only difference is decibels. The only difference. I know what colors she likes. I know all that stuff, you know. I didn't know any of those things about my first wife. The reason I didn't is because I didn't have time. I was too busy becoming somebody. I don't want to be anybody. I don't have to be anywhere, anyplace. You know, I don't have to be anywhere in the world tonight. Being here is a privilege because I learned how to love. And then when I look over and I see guys, you know, I see guys from Victorville, two of them, for Christ's sake, from Victorville, North Hollywood, down near San Diego, you know, and the old buzzard from Oxnard, Wolford. Everybody, you know, people that were, they're just here. And the funny part about it is that I love them. And I know they love me. And the hardest thing for me was not learning to love you, was the fact that I was worthy of being loved by you and knowing that you meant it, and you did. And now that I know that you do, and it almost blows me away. It really just almost blows me away. Because Chamberlain told me, he said, he come back. You'll find out that the creator of this universe didn't make a mistake when he made you, no more than he did anybody else. But you got to find out who you are. And slowly as you find out who you are, one day instead of going around praying, give me this and give me that and all these kind of other prayers, and trying to figure out a new form of yogi, you've come up with the greatest prayer you'll ever learn. Thank you, God, for making me me. And AA is the program that does it. It makes me me and makes you you. And there isn't any better you than you and no better me than me. If we stick together and love one another, we're going to be the best me's and the best you's that ever was. We're going to do all kinds of funny things. My wife didn't even finish high school. Here she is now with 3 degrees teaching school. You can't do that. She can do an AA. Do almost anything if you just stay here. If you drink, we know what you can do. But staying here, the limits are unlimited. But the most important part is that we learn to love. And without love, there isn't anything else. There isn't anything else. So I love the love of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's sobriety to me. Thank you very much.